Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, you know, a founder that has done it, you know, a bunch of times. You know, we're going to be talking about the building, scaling, financing, exiting, you know, as well. You know, in this case, he was ringing the bell, you know, IPOing his company at just 23 years old. And again, we'll talk about, you know, how to think about getting started, how to, you know, switch perhaps, you know, like a little bit more like the problem that you're tackling, how to deal with projects in the Middle East, also how to deal with projects also in North America. So in this case, you know, there's all types of geographic locations that our founder, you know, really covered. But again, you know, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Sami Karebi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's a pleasure to be on.
So originally born in Saudi Arabia, but you came to Toronto quite early. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
You know, it was a very pleasant life, and you know, I'm very thankful for it. So born in Saudi Arabia, I'm of Palestinian descent. And at the age of three, I moved to Toronto, where I spent my formative years. Grew up in Toronto in the 80s and 90s. Very safe, very comfortable city, extremely multicultural. And I think all of those different factors really did play a role in my development. Getting the exposure to many different cultures, being kind of in an education system and environment that really did promote entrepreneurship in many ways. And to be honest, actually growing up in a household that really promoted entrepreneurship allowed for me not to look at it as a big deal to try to start something. There was always that, you know, that enthusiasm and that support within my house from my parents, and then actually from the broader system to allow to really take on things from a very young age in terms of trying new things, trying new companies, or, you know, selling books on the street corner or doing those kinds of things from a very young age, and realizing that part of it really is within kind of your DNA and the nurture that occurs as well.
What about, you know, the entrepreneurship path that you took, you know, really early on? I mean, literally like right after university, you got started right away. I mean, where would you say that entrepreneurial drive comes from for you?
You know, I think it was, we call it entrepreneurial drive, but to me, it was just the baseline. I grew up in, my father was an entrepreneur, you know, on my mother's side, my uncles, my grandparents all had the entrepreneurial gene as well. And I think a lot of that was also, they moved around a lot in their life, I think based kind of on, you know, their history, and they had to start new a few times. And in order to do so, you really had to kind of build something yourself. And it was just all around me. And for me, entrepreneurship was just that expected path almost. And, you know, I really did embrace it. And where it's often viewed as a challenge or something that's very different, for me, it seemed to be the path that was almost written.
So let's talk about that moment, you know, when you got started, you know, with the company, right, with your first company right out of after university. How did that happen?
So, you know, I think it was the right time and the right place. So I graduated from university in Ontario. And shortly after, I was having a coffee with a gentleman who was an old friend of the family's, who was involved in an incubator focused on building resource companies. We had a conversation and I was just very keen to get involved. I thought that office itself was a very entrepreneurial environment. And that allowed for me to, from very early days, look at the opportunity set that was out there in terms of the resource market. Toronto has always been a market that's very focused on resources, the capital markets, whether it's early stage exploration for mining, all the way through to oil and gas production, typically within Canada. We had a very mature market in terms of the capital structures and the capital flows. And I said, you know, I come from a Middle Eastern background, let's look at some opportunities of assets in the Middle East. And through our network, we identified some gas licenses in Tunisia. And it was a very obvious arbitrage. The capital markets in Canada were willing to buy these assets at a multiple than what we could acquire them for in Tunisia at the time. And that was really the catalyst for the company. So myself and a few of the co-founders, or two other co-founders, I should say, decided to start Candax in 2004. At that point, oil was trading at around $25 a barrel. the capital markets for resources were very active and quite hot, specifically within Toronto. And I was fresh out of university, as you said, right? A 26-year-old, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and thought, I'm going to get myself involved into this journey, not really knowing what was going to be ahead of me. Where I was very fortunate was my two partners were well into their careers, very experienced entrepreneurs and within the capital markets. And that allowed for me to learn and very often be a fly on the wall, just absorbing what was being said in the room. And to be frank, very often learning on the go. I, you know, sit down, have a meeting, take notes, and then go actually translate what those notes meant for myself to really understand what was going on. And it was the quickest and the most in-depth, I could say, MBA one could possibly get, is to really get involved in that sector. And from 2004, from when we founded the company until 2006, when we IPO'd, we had a real convergence of events that really benefited what we were doing. First of all, we were in a market where oil had gone from $25 a barrel to inching on $100 a barrel. Second of all, the capital markets were getting hotter and hotter in terms of investments within resources. And third, we were very able to build an ideal team around everything based on the experience and the network that was around the other founders and myself. And that was very unique. You know, I don't think that happens every day. And so going kind of from, you know, 2004 idea, 2006 IPO, that was my first experience in entrepreneurship and founding a company. And it was, you know, I think it was quite surreal because it all happened so fast. It kind of felt like I was taken by a tornado and then landed in this kind of incredible experience of listing a company.
Now, in your case, I mean, listing the company, you were 23. So ringing the bell, you know, around that age, you know, is quite remarkable, you know, being able to see something that at the peak, you know, was about 250 million, you know, of a business is really spectacular. But I guess that, you know, it also gives you that thinking of maybe like feeling out of place, no? I mean, how was that experience, you know, in that regard as well?
Look, I think you touched on it perfectly, Alejandro. I think throughout the process, even before the listing, in many occasions, you do have a bit of an imposter syndrome, right? You're not realizing or not knowing really what's going on around you perfectly at the time and having to go back and learn, always being the youngest guy in the room and very often feeling out of place because of that, right? I think specifically the oil sector and the energy business at that time was kind of an older business, for lack of a better term as well, in terms of who was working in it and kind of the gates that were around it. And, you know, that made me feel out of place to some extent, but at the same time, it allowed me to be this kind of unique individual in the room that was very differentiated from my peers and my colleagues around me, which allowed me to learn so much from each of them, whether it was on the legal side, on the capital market side, on the general deal structures. It was just such an intense learning experience. And coming to ringing the bell and being surrounded by the bankers, the lawyers, my co-founders, our partners and investors within the deal, I did feel like I'm here. Maybe I shouldn't be here, but I am here. And I was so grateful to be there. And I think it really shaped how I started building things and approaching things in future companies as well.
So talking about future companies, eventually, you know, as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So eventually the next chapter, you know, came knocking, and that was with Enviromina. So how did that, you know, unfold? Because obviously you're coming now from the first chapter. It sounds like it was the perfect storm, you know, young, you know, hungry still. How did the whole idea of Enviromina come to mind, and why did you think it made sense to take that one on?
So in 2006, I was on one of my business trips for business development specifically. Our company, as I mentioned before, was looking for assets in the Middle East, North Africa under this thesis of the arbitrage, being able to pick them up at a lower cost than the capital markets were giving us for them. And in 2006, I traveled to Abu Dhabi and met with what was, you know, at that point still a nascent, which was the Sovereign Wealth Fund. And when meeting with them, I was meeting specifically with their energies and utility team. I had a conversation with that team about understanding if they had any assets that were too small for them, or they had seen any assets that were too small for them, but would really make sense for a company like Candax to acquire, or to at least, you know, do some further diligence on. And they didn't have assets of the sort, but they said, look, we are in search of some energy entrepreneurs right now. because we want to make Abu Dhabi a global epicenter for renewable energy. And at that time, there was zero renewable energy across the Middle East, North Africa. It was a very foreign concept to have that. And as I mentioned before, I was coming from an oil and gas background, and typically that was a kind of older market. It was less emphasis on technology and innovation and more emphasis on transactions and growth and scale, but it wasn't a tech industry per se. And I grew up obsessed with technology. I was always kind of a bit of a tech nerd at heart. And I started looking into renewable energy and solar energy specifically. And it was this beautiful marriage of technology and energy, and it was changing at such a rapid pace. So I had the conversation with the folks in Abu Dhabi and said, you know, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to go back to Toronto. It was January of 2006. And I'm going to think about this more. I landed in Toronto. It was 25 degrees in Abu Dhabi, minus 25 degrees when I landed in Toronto. And I thought, you know, maybe it's an opportunity to move to a sunny, warm place to start a solar company. And I was fortunate that my roommate and very good friend to this day was a solar engineer. So I asked him, you know, would you be interested in moving to Abu Dhabi, where he's never been, and starting a solar company? He said, sure. We brought on board one more co-founder who was a good friend of both of us too. And we had a great dynamic. Each one of us really had our talent and our approach to things, which was incredibly simple. And by 2007, by July 2000, I co-founded and we raised around $5 million of seed funding at the time. Funding was not labeled in seed or series A or anything along those times. We were able to raise some capital at a priced round from the get-go and started the first solar company in the Middle East, North Africa in 2007 in Abu Dhabi, which was, you know, an incredibly exciting yet incredibly daunting task.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about the, you know, what ended up being the business model there. You know, how are you guys making money with Envarumina?
So, you know, for starters, we went there and said, we want to be a solar company based out of Abu Dhabi, focused on the Middle East region. And to be perfectly honest with you, Alejandro, we didn't have an incredibly defined business plan because the market itself was so nascent that we had to be fluid with the direction it took. So we started actually with the idea that solar lighting could be the correct approach to entering and getting a foothold into the market while the policies and the larger solar projects came into play. And we moved and we, you know, brought in some demo units and hired a small team around that. And in less than a year, we ended up receiving a tender to bid on the first solar plant in the Middle East, North Africa. And that was much larger than anything we had put in our predictions. And, you know, we were, as an internal core team, definitely going to be biting off more than we thought we could chew by going after this project. But again, being, I think, 27 and again, very new to the market and everything, we decided, you know what, let's just do it. Let's just go for it. Let's bite off more than we think we can chew and make it happen. And we bid on the project. We were able to bring on board a partner that brought a lot of the relevant experience. They were, at the time, the largest solar manufacturer in the world, based out of China, a company by the name of Suntech. And together in consortium, we bid on the project and we won it. And it was just, you know, I think probably one of the most exciting days of our journey in our lives, being going from kind of zero and three guys and an idea to having being the signatory on a $50 million contract to build the first solar plant in the Middle East, North Africa. But at the same time, it was also an incredibly scary thing to sign that contract because we had 10 months to figure it out. And by figuring that out, that means build a team, ensure that you could do all the financing and bonding and funding, and get the first solar plant in the region delivered and installed in a time, and in Abu Dhabi in 2009 was booming on all fronts. So access to resources, contracting, housing, you name it, was very challenging to do. So it was a real convergence of challenges and opportunities that were, I would say, to this day, the real company builder. That's how we established the core team. And that's what kind of took us to the next level as an organization. And in 2010, we were the first recipient, I would say, of venture capital as a company out of the UAE, of international venture capital. So there was no such thing as a VC ecosystem in the Middle East, in the Gulf at that point, which seems like a very strange thing now because virtually all companies and capital allocators come to the region to try to raise capital. Back then, there was our backyard did not have any available capital. We as a UAE company had to go abroad to try to raise funding for our business. And so ended up with multiple roadshows in the US, Canada, throughout Europe, and ended up attracting at the time the largest clean tech fund out of Europe and the largest clean tech fund out of the US. And both became significant minorities in the business. And that itself, again, we kind of went from, I went from an experience of very quickly going from idea to IPO. This was 2009. The capital markets had just gone through the crash. The amount of time it took to raise, the challenges it was to raise a much smaller amount of capital took almost the amount of time it took us from idea to IPO in the previous cycle. And that was kind of my first lesson of the importance of timing and the importance of understanding when you can't have a bird in hand, make sure you do it. And, you know, ensure that you have the necessary funding to be comfortable to really have continuity within your business and deliver on operational success as well.
I mean, in this case, it ended up being quite a success with Evaramina. I mean, the company got acquired and there was like multiples there, you know, on return to the investors. I guess, what was that process like? Because the last company, you did the IPO, so it was a different type of liquidity event. You know, on this one, essentially, it went through an acquisition. How was that first time, you know, acquisition experience for you? How did that come about?
It was a very unique experience. So, you know, I think first and foremost, when we made our initial business plan, we had a 3-year idea to get to exit. All right. Again, so the expectation, I was kind of spoiled from the first experience in the context of expectations. Second time around, it took 11 years. And I was the CEO of that business. So it really was myself and my co-founder's baby. We would live, breathe, eat, sleep in Viramina on a daily basis. And in many ways, I felt like it was almost defining my character, right? And it was a very exciting journey as well. We built the first solar project in 7 countries across the region. And so, you know, pioneering time and time again in terms of enabling and being really part of the seeds of creation of multiple markets that now are very mature, that are doing gigawatts of scale. And, you know, kind of being part of that foundation of it and proving with technology, regulation, and coordinating with all the different bodies to get the projects over the line was a fascinating experience. And we were able to bring on Mustar, which is wholly owned by the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Abu Dhabi at the time, as our largest minority shareholder as well. So we really had a dream team of shareholders in the business. And despite it taking 11 years, They sat on our board. They provided incredible advice. And they really were also a critical part of our success as an organization, because we were able to go to, you know, investors that had experience in sustainability and investors that truly had in-depth understanding of our region. And they all respected each other in a way which was extremely cohesive, and also really respected the autonomy of us as the management team to go deliver and do our thing. They believed in us. There were checks and balances, all the structures that were required to get things done. But ultimately, as long as we worked within those parameters, we were able to run through walls and get projects done. And by the time we were acquired in 2017 by a pension fund out of the UK, we had operations in 9 countries. We had around $750 million in revenue, and we were a business at scale. And being part of that from day zero was incredible. But then selling that, and as you just asked, Mahendra, you know, what was it like to be acquired? Very different feeling than the listing. And I think probably a function of two things. One was my time and involvement in this one was with so much more depth. And the second thing was, once you're acquired and you have a single shareholder, you really need to kind of answer to another strategy, or you need to, you know, I think you're beholden to whatever the kind of, you know, investor or acquirer really wants as their strategy, whether it's something that you're aligned with or not. And I had 1 year of kind of having to run the business that, you know, that was my baby, but now had grown and had gone onto its own. And that was a, you know, I think that was a very unique experience as well. Interesting, because again, as I mentioned, we went from venture capital to pension capital, and understanding the different expectations and attitudes of all the different kinds of investors. I knew at that point that it was, you know, my core expertise and where I want to sit again is going back to day zero and going back to day one. So a year after the acquisition of the business, myself and the co-founders all stepped away from business, and I started Incubate Investments. The reason I started Incubate, and I think one of the things I told myself right away when I started Incubate, was I want to be an investor. I was very fortunate to have had 2 successful exits under my belt at that point, which enabled me to really take a look at the opportunity of interesting early stage businesses with a focus on the region, with a focus on sustainability and technology, try to seed bright young people with big ideas and provide my experience to the extent that I can to help them turn their ideas into businesses and hopefully into scale-ups as well. And through Incubate, I've made around 30 investments, have been a very active investor in many of those businesses, and have really tried to support them across multiple fronts. I've seen a few exits already. We've seen, you know, some very interesting additional funding rounds and some big successes within the portfolio since starting it in 2019. But I would invest in these businesses. But Alejandro, I would sometimes be a bit jealous of the entrepreneurs as they were telling me about their day-to-day and about their journeys. And I couldn't scratch the itch by just being an investor anymore. And that got me back into venture building. And in 2001, we built a venture out of Incubate, which I'm effectively founding and being a very active part of the team, named Wisewell, which is a company that is really trying to disrupt the way we drink and deliver water. Today, 600 billion plastic bottles are thrown out for the bottled water industry. It is a $400 billion sector, growing at a 6% CAGR. And we've learned that it's bad for the environment. It's bad for our wallets because it's expensive to drink bottled water. And over the past couple of years, we're realizing it's actually bad for our health as well. So it reminded me of kind of that perfect storm of what was happening within solar energy. The cost of solar went down, carbon emissions, a real issue, and people realized that, hold on, there's a better way to build energy. And that's what we're trying to do now. There's a better way for people to drink and deliver water through incredibly intelligent purification systems. And we're going after a very fragmented market and trying to build something from day one, which is a scalable technology business. That's kind of a marriage of venture capital with a private equity mindset to scale and create yield in very short order.
So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Wisewell is fully realized, what does that world look like?
There'd be a lot less plastic in landfills, in the ocean. And I'd say equally, if not more importantly, in our body. People would be spending less on bottled water. There are parts of the world where people are spending a significant percentage of their disposable income on hydration, where what is coming out of the tap in virtually every country in the world is 95% there. We need that 5% refinement at the point of consumption, at the point of use, to turn any kind of tap water into the highest quality mineralized water. And today's technology exists. It's a function of packaging it and, you know, effectively selling it correctly. And for whatever reason, you know, we haven't seen many examples of that in most parts of the world. And we think where this problem lies is a tremendous opportunity. So that world would see, you know, a $200 billion purification market and a much smaller bottled water market as ultimately the use case for it declines further and further.
So now I put you into a time machine, Sammy, and I bring you back in time to Canada, to Ontario, right? You know, to that moment where you were graduating, let's say May 2003. And you're able to have a chat with that younger self, that younger Sammy that, you know, has saying that thing, you know, thinking, oh, hey, I'm thinking about maybe doing something, you know, of my own. And you're able to show up and have a chat with that younger self. And you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I would tell my younger self that it's absolutely critical to take a step back sometimes and breathe and look at things from outside looking in. Very often when you're a founder and you're with your co-founders and you're really in the weeds within a business, you will make assumptions on behalf of other people, because you've convinced yourself so much, you think that's actually what the whole world thinks. And very often you need to be critical of your own views and really ensure that you don't get so caught up in the weeds of what you're doing that you're missing some of the other things that are going on out there. And although we were very fortunate and we built scalable businesses across geographies and sectors, you know, the scale of that opportunity could have been bigger had my younger self known that, you know, you don't just want to look at what you're doing and be the best at that. There could be some broader opportunities to go from millions to hundreds of millions or hundreds of millions to billions in terms of revenue, market cap, whatever the case may be.
So, Sammy, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So I am quite active on LinkedIn. My name is right there. So please add me. I accept every single invitation, and then drop me a note. And I'd always be more than happy to chat with aspiring entrepreneurs, interested investors, or people who just want to have an interesting conversation.
Amazing. Well, hey, well, Sammy, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
The honor was mine, Alejandro. I appreciate your time.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.